From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we remember the life and legacy of former Michigan Senator Carl Levin, who died last night. We'll listen back to my interview earlier this year with Levin. We'll also speak with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. The Dingells and Levin's friendship and work together spans generations.
Carl Levin was a smart, unflappable, ferocious fighter who came prepared and knew every detail.
And we'll talk more about the Olympics. First, whether they're still relevant and what this year's gymnastics competition is doing for our conversation about mental health.
It is a much easier narrative to say, oh, she's just weak, she just can't hack it, than to deal with the reality of what abuse and trauma in any form does to a person.
Those conversations coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Former longtime senator representing Michigan, Carl Levin, has died at 87. Carl Levin is remembered and respected as a serious lawmaker who revered the Senate's role in government, the nuance of policy and policymaking. He valued bipartisan collegiality and serving his constituents. And he suffered no fools, especially those who came before his committees, as this Goldman Sachs executive found out after the financial crisis of 2008.
The context, let me tell you, the context is mighty clear. June 22 is the date of this email. Boy, that Timberwolf was one shitty deal. How much of that shitty deal did you sell to your clients after June 22, 2007?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that, but the price would have reflected levels that they wanted to invest in.
Oh, of course. But they don't know what it says. You didn't tell them you thought it was a shitty deal.
Well, I didn't say that.
No. Who did? Your people, internally. You knew it was a shitty deal, and that's what your email shows.
Later in the program, we will reflect on a generational talent in public service who represented our state in the U.S. Senate longer than any other. But first, the Summer Olympics in Tokyo are proving a great stage for so many athletes. We are super excited to watch Michigan-born BMX freestyler Hannah Roberts compete this weekend. She gave a great interview this month about going to Tokyo. If you missed us, it's part of our podcast feed. So much has happened to pull off these delayed summer games. You have to wonder, is the financial and human toll worth it? And will the tragedies of last year and this one eternally hang over our memories of these games? Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon wrote about this recently for the Washington Post, and he joins us now. John, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much, April. Always a pleasure.
What, other than the obvious lack of crowds, feels different to you this year?
The energy, and also what one of the great things about the Olympics is that we all tend to watch it. It is a shared story, and we have, I think, very few shared stories left anymore. And this year, it kind of isn't. The ratings are at dramatic lows, 30-year lows. So you watch something cool, and you get online or get on the phone to talk to your friends, and they don't know what you're talking about. So that happens a lot.
You know, it is a shared story, but I'm just getting the feeling that the interpretation of the story is so different this year because of, you know, the myriad of reactions to Simone Biles pulling herself out of team competition. And yet you say in your op-ed that you feel we shouldn't dismiss the results of these games too much. What do you mean by that?
Well, some folks are calling it the asterisk Olympics, and I get why. I mean, there are no fans, obviously. Some great athletes like Serena Williams did not come this time due to COVID precautions. She could not bring her 3-year-old daughter. Becca Myers, the deafblind 2-time Paralympic swimmer, she requires a personal care assistant to navigate the airport, the pool deck, and the dining hall. And in all its infinite wisdom, the U.S. Olympic Committee said you can't bring your personal assistant, so she had to drop out heartbroken. So some of the stars are not going to be at the Olympics and the Paralympics. So that's an aspect there. And yet, the myth is that somehow the Olympics have always brought together the world's best at their best, and that has virtually never been true. Not just World War I and World War II, obviously, which cost us 3 Olympics in themselves, and how many great athletes, of course. In 84, the boycott by the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet bloc back then. Look, Mary Lou Retton still won gold medal, of course, and 4 other medals, and that beaming smile was still on the cover of Sports Illustrated and the Wheaties box. So what you get is the best available doing the best they can. and we have that again.
Well, no argument. There's no such thing as a pure Olympics, but I may mean something different than you do in that. In seriousness, though, John, we have seen some athletes, Des Linden comes to mind, who used the pandemic lockdown and was able to crush some of her own private assumptions about what she was capable of. Now, to be clear, Des is not competing. She did not qualify for Tokyo, but I just mean in terms of how she was thinking about her performance. And at the same time, there's some people like Simone Biles who are dealing with injuries and in radically different psychological spaces with competing. And yet, are you suggesting we should view their performances according to a traditional standard?
No, what I'm suggesting is basically the opposite in terms of everyone out there is doing the best they can. And the idea that somehow the competition is watered down or doesn't mean as much this time is ridiculous, because for almost all athletes, I would certainly include Simone in this, it's been harder. A, waiting a year. B, all kinds of bizarre training regimens they've had to pursue. You know, weightlifters doing squats in their kitchens and this kind of stuff. It's been harder for almost everybody. So if that's the case, do not discount what they achieve.
Do you think it was the right call to cowgirl up and go on with the games in spite of the possible threats from COVID?
Yes, I do. And I realize that there are all kinds of negative reactions to that. At some point, you have to move on. Do the best you can. Now, I think some of the policies are dated for COVID protections, and some are not up to speed. Like, I don't know why Tokyo couldn't simply say, look, you have to be vaccinated unless you can show why you shouldn't be vaccinated. The guys I know over there are getting tested 2, 3, 4 times a day, even though they've been double vaccinated, and they're terrified of getting a false positive, which does happen, which can knock you out in itself. So I would not salute Tokyo's work on the science, but I would salute the idea of we're doing the best we can. This seems to me reasonably safe. We've not heard of any great outbreaks. So I think it's not a bad call to do this, and I think we kind of need it.
Certainly. I mean, I could see the argument that in the case of 1948, people desperately needed diversion, and they needed new faces for national identity at that time. Do you think that's really something, a case we can make now? Yes, it's been a devastating couple of years, but it seems that we're putting athletes at risk by sending them, almost certainly putting Japanese people at risk by holding this event there, just so that the IOC and the commercial apparatus of sports marketing can be satisfied?
Well, that part cannot be defended, obviously. So like most topics these days, and the Olympics are so complicated, so vast, of course, and touch so many things. There's no way you can say thumbs up, thumbs down. This is good. This is bad. It's too simple.
Mm-hmm.
The IOC ranks only behind FIFA, the governing body of soccer worldwide, as the most. Here's my corrupt Olympics. I've got FIFA getting gold, soccer, IOC second, and the NCAA third. It's a very impressive podium. So and these guys always medal. Those guys, the IOC is utterly corrupt, and it has almost been designed to be corrupt for at least 50 or 60 years. So I'm not going to defend them, the commercialization of it, of course, the let's get a buck on the back of these people. So none of that can be defended. If Tokyo can get the science right, if they can get the protocols right, so they are certainly as safe as being out in the regular world, then, you know, fair enough. But if they can't do that, if they're too sloppy with that, then it's a different reaction.
You know, reading what you wrote, I found myself wondering if the athletes themselves would be able to erase the asterisk in their own mind. What do you think about that?
The ones I've talked to, which is hardly all of them, of course, there are thousands. I've talked to probably 10 or 15. No, they said this has been the hardest training they've ever had. What they have access to this time around is not the same as what they usually have, of course, in terms of group training is a big part of any athletic competition, obviously, preparation. Your teammates, your relay partners, the proper pool, a 50-meter pool instead of a pond that Ledecky swam in Bloomington with snapping turtles, for example. That's got to be on the list somewhere. These guys, I think, will not think twice about a medal they win. The ones I've talked to have been very adamant about that. Quietly adamant, but adamant.
John, have you had any favorite watches or just moments that you were still able to wring some enjoyment out of in the game so far?
I have to admit, not as many as usual. And of course, you're looking to, you know, some big stars for those and some unknown stars, some lesser known athletes. But you know what? What I love about Olympics every time is the first day they showed me tennis. That's pro tennis that I was watching just a week ago, of course, with Wimbledon. But then when they switched to team handball, I love seeing sports I'm not going to see otherwise that are pretty cool sports. You get a lot of volleyball. We don't watch too much of that in the United States. So that has all been good. The energy of the athletes, despite not having 48,000 fans cheering for you, they're as engaged as ever. They're as competitive as ever. And seeing some shred of normality of the human spirit, if I dare say it, has been reassuring.
Well, I'll tell you something I learned is I need to start paying attention to the U of M swimming program.
Yes, indeed.
We had
you have Olympics in your backyard.
Yes. Michigan alumna Siobhan Haughey made history, really, getting a silver medal in the 200-meter freestyle. And she was actually swimming for Hong Kong. And I think that was their first swimming medal.
I think it was.
The guy who's the assistant diving coach, Michael Hickson, and his diving partner got a silver medal for synchronized 3-meter springboard diving. And then there was U of M's senior Maggie McNeil, who won the gold in the 100-meter butterfly. I had no idea these riches were like right in our own backyard.
Well, that's the beauty of the Olympics. We sadly ignore most athletes outside of football, basketball, you know, the major team sports in the United States. We largely ignore them until this great stage comes up. And how else do you discover these world-class athletes in your backyard? And here they are on the gigantic world stage. I've had a few of those athletes in my classes. And my class is 8:30 in the morning. And they get there, they've already been up for 3 hours. They've already gone through an hour and a half in the pool. They're eating a breakfast, which I allow them to do so in their, in their little desk there, of course. Then they're off for the next thing. And then they're going to swim again before the day is done. So the sacrifices over many years to see them get this chance, that is why I still believe, on the whole, it's better that we did this than we didn't, provided it can be done reasonably safely.
Any other Michiganders you'll have an eye on for the remainder of the games?
Absolutely, of course. Nick Willis, I wrote about in the Washington Post op-ed that ran on Tuesday. He's one of my neighbors. He's now 38 years old, five-time Olympian in the 1500 meter, 1.5K meter, which is the first guy to do that, second guy to do that all time. And then we've got my next door neighbor, not kidding you, Mason Furlick, God bless him, was the NCAA champion 3,000 meter steeplechase. So something in the water in my neighborhood is really fast, but I'm not drinking the same stuff.
John U. Bacon. You can read his recent work in the pages of the Washington Post. He also has a book coming out this fall called Let Them Lead, Unexpected Lessons in Leadership from America's Worst High School Hockey Team. John, thank you.
Thank you, April.
Watching Olympic gymnastics has not been the same since former Dr. Larry Nassar was arrested for sexually abusing hundreds of athletes. Next up, an advocate for survivors talks about the new lens Simone Biles has given us for this year's games. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Suni Lee brought home the gold yesterday in the women's gymnastics all-around final. Permit us a moment of Midwestern pride for this. To quote a tweet from Team USA, Lee stuck it cold like Minnesota with picture-perfect performances on the vault, the uneven bars, and the floor. She is, by the way, the first Hmong American Olympian. No one can take away what this year's athletes have achieved in Tokyo, getting through COVID on top of all the outsized pressures of elite competition. But maybe we've been especially mindful of the women of the U.S. gymnastics team. It's been 5 years since Larry Nassar's arrest blew open the story of what young women and girls had survived during his time as doctor to the team and to many other athletes as well. This is the first Olympics since the toxicity of Nassar and elite gymnastics became wide public knowledge, and that unspooling is due in part to our next guest and her work. Rachel Den Hollander was the first woman to publicly come forward through legal and print media channels about the abuse that she suffered by Larry Nassar. She's now an attorney, an author, and an advocate. Rachel Den Hollander, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have you had an eye on Tokyo this summer?
Oh, you know, the Olympics bring up so many memories for all of us. The love of the sport and all of it, all that it can be and should be, is absolutely there. So there has been a lot of just really eager anticipation to enjoy the incredible athleticism of the world's best athletes. But there's a lot of trauma and hurt that comes with it, too, because along with the Olympics comes the anniversary of the IndyStar article coming out, and a lot of those anniversaries for where USAG had some of their most egregious behavior, gaslighting Simone, covering up the abuse, failing to disclose what was going on. So there's a lot of pain that comes along with it, too.
Yeah. For those who maybe don't follow this quite as closely, Simone Biles, the greatest of all time and star of the U.S. team, of course,
was in the headlines this week because of a decision she made, but she was the only, I believe, member of the Olympic team who's still on the team who was a patient of Larry Nassar and who survived him. When we think about the mental pressures that were on her, that absolutely has to be part of the conversation. We've heard Simone Biles talk about being this last figure on the team and her worry that without her, the story could get swept under the rug. Do you share that concern, Rachel?
It is always easier for corrupt institutions to sweep things under the rug when voices dissipate. And so I'm deeply, deeply grateful for the way Simone has used her power and her influence and her voice to be able to continue drawing attention. And I think part of just the horrifying reality of how she's been treated is if the world's best athlete and USAG's best gymnast receives this kind of treatment, imagine what's going on with all the lower level gymnasts, with athletes that don't have Simone's power and voice. And imagine what would be happening if there weren't hundreds of survivors constantly raising the alarms.
She has not had an easy week, having taken herself out of competition because of where her headspace was. And yet I kept thinking the world that she came up in and the world that you trained in was a place where women and girls had so little autonomy over their own bodies and over their own pain and whether or not they were going to compete. What was it like to see a gymnast at Simone Biles' level take herself out of competition?
You know, I ache so deeply for her because of everything that she's gone through and just the reality that she has poured so much of herself into the competition, and then to not be able to compete is just devastating. At the same time, you're right, watching her be able to have the choice to say no to something that was unsafe and unhealthy for her, watching her have autonomy over her own body, that's the change we've been working for right there. That's what so many athletes, from your low-level club gymnast to your elite athletes, haven't ever had. It was an incredible moment, despite the heartbreak.
What was going through your mind then when you saw people start to call out Biles for dropping out of the games?
Yeah, I get asked all the time, what's changed since Larry Nassar? You know, explain to me how we're in a better place. And I think what we saw this week is that we really haven't changed very much. Our understanding of trauma and mental health and the long-term ramifications of every form of abuse and gaslighting, we don't understand, and we don't really care to a large degree about the damage that those things do. It is a much easier narrative to say, oh, she's just weak, she just can't hack it, than to deal with the reality of what abuse and trauma in any form does to a person. And what's really happening right now that just breaks my heart is there are so many others who are struggling with the mental health ramifications of abuse and trauma who are watching this cultural conversation. And the question and the reality that they're seeing is, if the greatest athlete of all time, who literally won championships with a kidney stone and multiple broken toes and, you know, and has proven herself in every possible way, if she can't even say, I can't do this right now, and be given the respect she deserves, who can raise their voice about mental health and trauma and be given any form of respect? If she can't do that, who can? Yeah. And what that does is it just reemphasizes to survivors to sit down and shut up, because we don't care and we're not going to believe you. It's been really painful to see the societal response from some quadrants to Simone and just the lack of understanding and the lack of willingness to understand.
You and your husband, Jacob, who's also a fierce advocate for survivors, were tweeting this week about the difference in the agency that Simone Biles was able to show versus the way that Carrie Strug was handled in 1996. She vaulted through an injury, broke her leg on the landing, and has been invoked time after time this week as some kind of ideal of what gymnasts should do in the interest of winning. How should we compare the handling of what Simone Biles and Carrie Strug went through and the outcomes?
Again, I think it shows our lack of understanding for the culture. You know, Carrie is a phenomenal athlete, and what she has accomplished should never be taken away from. At the same time, the idea that she had a choice in what she did shows just an incredible lack of understanding for the culture of USA Gymnastics. There is no actual way to know what Carrie would have done if she had been given the choice to have agency, if she hadn't been raised in a system that was abusive in every way, shape, and form. And so to compare the two is not an accurate comparison. and it completely bypasses the reality of what Carrie grew up in. You know, I saw Larry just a few years after that vault, and Larry told me himself, Carrie was just being a drama queen. It was just a minor sprain. She was in it for attention. Mm-hmm. So what we have to realize is Carrie was growing up in a system that was emotionally and physically abusive at minimum, and attended to by medical professionals and coaches, where that was their attitude. A third degree ligament tear was just a sprain, and she was being a drama queen for attention. She had no choice. There is no way to know what kind of choice she would have made if she had had a choice. So to compare the two is apples and oranges. It also ignores everything Simone has overcome from an injury perspective. Like, Simone hasn't done those same things herself. Again, it's just incredibly ignorant. She's competed with multiple broken toes and stress fractures. She won the world championships with a kidney stone, for goodness sakes. The lack of knowledge in those comparisons, again, is just astounding. And it's inexcusable, because the reality of what of the system that Carrie grew up in has been long known. It is willful ignorance at this point in time.
Can I ask you a quick technical question?
Absolutely.
When Simone Biles described what she was going through mentally, not knowing where she was in the air when she was in the midst of competing, did you know what she was talking about?
Yeah, every gymnast has that experience at some point in time. Yeah, and sometimes it's just a one-time experience, losing your air sense. But especially for elite gymnasts, that kind of mental block can extend for weeks. And we know, just in general, when it comes to trauma and stress, that can create incredible mental blocks. And to be competing at any level of gymnastics and not be able to sense where your body is incredibly dangerous. But to be competing at that level of gymnastics and to not know where your body is can literally be life and death.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is attorney, author, and advocate Rachel Den Hollander. She's also a former gymnast. Rachel, do you see substantial changes in the generation of coaches who are now working with the U.S. Olympic team? You know, we see figures like Tom Forrester and Sarah Jancy, and we want so badly to believe that things are different now, that no one like the Carolis or John Gettert will be trusted with athletes again. What's your read on the team that you see?
All I think we have to do to look at that is to look at the so many coaches' responses and USAG leaders' responses to Maggie Haney's process with Safe Sport. Maggie Haney is one of the worst abusive coaches. A, it took years to get her banned before Safe Sport would act. And when she was, so many USAG leaders, USAG judges, and other coaches came to her defense, despite the well-documented evidence of incredible emotional and even physical abuse that Maggie was perpetrating. Some of the most abusive coaches over the decades are still coaches at the elite level. So no, USAG has not reckoned in any way, shape, or form with the level of abuse that is taking place in their organization. They have done nothing proactively to address the abuse with these coaches. You know, I find it very interesting that, you know, Jen Say wrote an entire book about her experience where she's laying out significant abuse that she suffered at the hands of her coaches who own the gym parquets. And nobody followed up on that. Here you have an entire book that's laying out the abuse of her coaches, and nobody followed up on that. So that the lack of proactivity demonstrates a lack of care. The incredible amount of time it takes demonstrates a lack of care. And the retaliatory responses to the athletes that do file Safe Sport complaints and the quick rushing to defend coaches who have engaged in just atrocious behavior shows a lack of change.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt, but we could and probably should talk about the administrative picture. Just a couple of weeks ago, we got a lot more public detail about the extent of the corruption within USA Gymnastics with the Investigator General's report about how the FBI mishandled the Nassar investigation. Civil cases are ongoing, and we should note that USA Gymnastics is still fighting to protect its past leaders, Steve Penny and others. Do you see the civil litigation being able to force some real change within USA Gymnastics? Do you think that is, I mean, it's just unclear whether any further criminal response is going to be forthcoming from the Justice Department.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of hope for our criminal processes, to be honest. You know, we see failures there at every possible level when it comes even to the Nassar investigation, but just across the board when it comes to issues of sexual and physical abuse. So I don't expect to see any more justice, as wrong as that is, coming from our criminal processes. The ability to push change through the civil process is critical and important, but you can only get so much done with an organization that is steadfastly pushing back at every turn. We have been engaged in civil litigation with USAG for almost 5 years now, 3 years with the bankruptcy process, and they are to this day, both USAG and USOPC, asserting that they had no duty to their athletes. These same athletes that were required to participate in this system, they had no duty to those athletes. And gymnastics is a little bit unique compared to some sports because you cannot compete in this sport unless you're a member of USAG. At the lowest level of competition, you have to be a USAG member to even compete in this sport. Your gym has to be a USAG certified gym. Your coach cannot be on the floor unless they're a USAG certified coach. USAG has control of their athletes, their coaches, and their gyms right down to the lowest level. And yet at the same time, they're saying we can control everything you do and you have to be certified through us and you cannot participate in the sport unless you satisfy all of our requirements. Yet we have no duty to you. The cognitive dissonance in those two realities is just astounding. And yet they are asserting to this day, we have no duty to our athletes.
Rachel, do you think the things that have happened in gymnastics over the past decade, do you see them affecting some of the other elite sports?
Yeah, actually, that's been really encouraging to see just from the standpoint of the more elite athletes and even club athletes are raising their voices, the more we're starting to see athletes from other disciplines coming forward and essentially saying, me too. I experienced very similar abusive coaching tactics. Sexual abuse is rampant in my organization. You know, here's what's taking place in all of these other disciplines. And interestingly enough, you also see those same governing bodies and the USOPC making the same arguments. We can control everything you do, but we have absolutely no duty to you. And so again, that level of cognitive dissonance, that lack of care, prioritizing of money and medals over individuals is a consistent thread we see, not just in the dynamics of these different institutions and athletic organizations, but in how they're responding to the whistleblowing.
I think it's getting hard, if indeed it was ever possible, to look at the Olympics and see what athletes put themselves through without feeling a twinge of guilt watching all this happen. That was obviously compounded exponentially by the revelation of what you and the other survivors had to tell us. But I'm thinking of Rebeca Andrade of Brazil, who was the silver medalist who very narrowly lost out to Suni Lee, and just the incredible discipline that everybody in the sport shows and the things that they are put through and sometimes put themselves through. After everything, do you think that we'll ever see people competing at the elite level without something like abuse or self-abuse?
Yeah, I think it is possible. Whether we're going to get there is another question. And I think that's going to entail some very hard conversations about what we actually value. And again, you see this coming out with a response to Simone. Yeah, as much as we say, oh, we value the person, we see these athletes as human, the response to Simone from a wide number of quadrants has communicated very clearly, very, very bluntly, we wanted you for a medal. You were a commodity to us. And the level of ownership that we feel over our athletes goes way beyond national pride in their accomplishments. The number of people saying Simone let her country down. What exactly has everybody else done to invest in Simone's athletic career? Did you fund her athletic career? You know, did you get her the medical care? Did you help her go to training? What exactly has the country in general done that we feel like Simone owes us something? You know, Simone is an athlete in her own right. And that idea of you owe us and we own you, that's not national pride. That's commoditization of a person.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a time when you were coaching. Are you coaching these days?
I don't, but I miss it. It was one of my favorite jobs.
Yeah. At the same time, you're a parent, you've got girls at home. What do you tell them about where to set the markers for their ambition, knowing what you know about how the world will support them and not support them?
I think we start with understanding our own identity and our own value. We start with the conversations of you're a multifaceted person. And I love all of these gifts and abilities that you have, and I want to see you cultivate them, but it's not worth sacrificing your ability everywhere else to be able to pursue this. So for example, with my girls, when we're talking about athletics, we talk about the realities of, you know, you need to ask those hard questions. Is it worth a permanent life-altering injury that impacts everything else you can do for the rest of your life? Is that really where your value and identity is? I think we start with those conversations because that lays the groundwork for then being able to make the decision if you want to pursue elite athletics and to understand how to hold those things in balance and to know, like Simone knew this week, that sometimes you might hit a point where, yes, you love the sport and you have poured yourself into it and you want to be the absolute best you can be and you have worked incredibly hard and shown incredible character in your pursuit of athletics, and yet the personal glory is not worth losing everything else that you have. It's not what identifies you. I think we lay that groundwork first because that's the healthy groundwork for being able to pursue high-level athletics and hold those things in balance and know when to say, I am worth more than the medal. And there are things that are more important to me, like my health and my physical safety and being a multifaceted person. And at some point, being able to step back and know your identity is not wrapped up in that. I love the fact that Simone modeled that for my girls.
Rachel Den Hollander, attorney, activist, educator, and author. She's been talking with us about watching the Olympics this year. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
In just a moment, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell remembers Senator Carl Levin.
We can disagree agreeably, be civil, look at life from different perspectives. That's one of the lessons Carl Levin taught us.
That's after the break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan is saying goodbye to one of its most venerated and long-lived public servants. Carl Levin died yesterday after a battle with lung cancer. He was 87. We last spoke with him in March.
My mother, she said, you're no better than anybody else, but nobody else is better than you, and never forget it.
We'll bring you more of that conversation in just a moment, but first we wanted to turn to Carl Levin's friend and colleague, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. Debbie, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, it's good to be with you, but I wish the subject wasn't the subject we're talking about today.
For sure. People remember Carl Levin's stern approach when he was chairing a committee hearing, getting titans of finance and industry to say things that they really didn't want to say, and the way that he would peep over his reading glasses, very calm, never rushed, before he would, you know, prod them on the question that would just crack people. Do you think that people who came before Carl Levin to testify underestimated him?
Well, I think if you were someone who came prepared as a witness, you wouldn't be stupid enough to make that mistake. But Carl Levin was a smart, unflappable, ferocious fighter who came prepared and knew every detail. And if you were appearing as a witness before his committee, you better do your homework, because he knew how to hold people accountable. And he believed in holding people accountable for the people that elected him. He felt his duty and responsibility to be a good public servant every single day.
What was he like behind the scenes with you?
He was, you know, he was one of John Dingell's best friends. The two of them, the Dingells and the Levin family go back for, I hate to say this, for almost 100 years. It's not quite 100 years, but.
Wow.
Carl's uncle, Ted Levin, and Sandy's uncle was nominated for the federal judge by John's father. Carl and Sandy campaigned when they were kids, 8 and 10 years old. They have pictures of campaigning for John's dad. But they were friends. They believed in public service. They believed in doing what was right. And they weren't afraid to stand up for what was right. But they were also the most down-to-earth, humble, never forgot where they came from, couldn't wait to get home and be home when they were in Washington, and never forgot who sent them to Washington or why they were there.
Were there ways that you saw he and John supporting each other with the complexities of a, you know, a very demanding job, or ways that they helped each other?
Well, they were great friends, but they'd see a problem, and they worked on many problems together. They were champions of the auto industry. They cleaned up the Great Lakes. They care deeply about the environment, champion national parks and state parks. They brought, you know, Carl's very much responsible for what happened in Warren with TACOM, the Defense and Selfridge Air Force Base. But they also weren't afraid to compromise. They had strong relationships on both sides of the aisle, and they'd see a problem, and they didn't feel like they were the only ones that had the answer. They'd talk about it. They'd talk about, okay, what perspectives? What are the different perspectives? What should we be doing? And they would meet with a lot of people, and they tried to find the answers. They would look at something not to get attention, not to get in the newspaper or the television, but they say, this is a problem that needs to be solved. And how do we solve it? How do we bring the people together that we need to do to address the root problem?
I'm looking at Michigan's representation right now, and I see Fred Upton and a bunch of people elected after 2010. Now, you yourself are sort of a bridge figure. You were elected in 2015, but you were in the room for so much of John's career and benefited, you know, when you did come to office from all that. When you think about the representation that Michigan has right now, how do we get more Carl Levin?
Well, we have to work at it. I mean, I think each of us has responsibility, and it's not only those that are elected to serve the people, but we need to look at what's happening in this country today, the fear and the hatred that's dividing us. And, you know, my favorite saying, John used to say it, the nuns taught it to me, God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason, to listen more and talk less. And there were giants that believed in public service. We demonize public service now. Public service is making our communities better. But we also need to look at what's happening every place, in our workplaces, in our schools, on Facebook, in our communities, at the division. And I think that people are attacking the fundamental pillars of our democracy. John Dingell and Carl Levin would have pushed back and weren't afraid to tell people, look at what is happening. And I challenge all of us to learn the lessons from great men like these. And let's try to respect each other more. We can disagree agreeably, be civil, look at life from different perspectives. That's one of the lessons Carl Levin taught us.
What can I just ask one more thing? What do you make of the fact that Senator Levin was working, writing, and teaching at Wayne State up until the very end of his life?
That he had a lot to give, and he never stopped working or fighting. John was the same way. John was dictating to me the day that he died. These were men that loved their country, their state. They were proud. John still called himself a Detroiter, too. Carl Levin never forgot the city he was born in, where his family roots were. He couldn't wait to get home to Detroit every weekend. And when he retired, he came home to Detroit. I don't want people to ever forget that Carl Levin was one of the strongest Tiger fans that ever cheered for them. And he'd look at abandoned buildings in Detroit and say, what are we going to do to bring them back? And, you know, these were great men, and we need to learn from them, and we need to build on the foundations that they laid for us, strong foundations that have the next generations building upon them.
Debbie Dingell, a Democrat representing Michigan's House District 12. Debbie, it's always a pleasure. Take care, and please give our best to the Levin family.
Thank you.
I interviewed Carl Levin a few months ago after the release of his memoir, Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. Let's listen to part of that conversation. There's so much interesting material in this book, it's kind of hard to know where to begin. But I think I want to start with a photo that appears in the book of you and most of the Michigan delegation. John Conyers is there, Fred Upton, Senator Stabenow is there. I think then-Governor Granholm appears in the photo as well, and of course, John Dingell. I just wanted to ask what you feel Michigan's leadership brings to the legislative branch that might not otherwise be there.
Well, the delegation from Michigan is always pulled together when it comes to issues for Michigan. We've worked on a bipartisan basis for Michigan's interest, and it was very productive, and I think still is productive when it comes to the issues that Michigan is most interested in. So, and the working together concept, which is so important for any legislative goal, is important for the nation too, and that's really what's been missing recently in Congress, is a willingness on the part of some to work across party lines to get things done that the country needs.
Can you think of an example in which something got done that had a real benefit in the lives of folks at home in Michigan that wouldn't have otherwise happened without the relationships that you developed over your time in office?
Well, I had a really wonderful relationship with a number of Republicans, including John McCain, John Warner. One example, for instance, with McCain was we had a hearing looking into tax abuses by the most profitable companies in the country that were not paying taxes at all or paying reduced taxes because they created these artificial entities overseas in tax havens so that they could avoid paying American taxes. Well, you got the wealthiest companies, the Googles, the Apples, and so forth, that are avoiding taxes. That puts a burden on the rest of us to keep the government's revenues going. And that includes, obviously, people in Michigan. It's not just a Michigan benefit. It's a national benefit, but it surely includes taxpayers in Michigan who have a tax burden. And we should not be carrying that burden for the wealthiest among us, including those corporations. And so McCain took a very gutsy position. He went after the president of Apple at a hearing with me in our oversight hearing at Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And he took him on with me.
Apple's a great company, but no company should be able to determine how much it's going to pay in taxes, how many profits they're going to keep offshore, how they're going to bring them back home, using all kinds of gimmicks to avoid paying the taxes that should be paid to this country.
It's completely outrageous that Apple has not only dodged full payment of U.S. taxes, but it's managed to evade paying taxes around the world.
And, you know, if for a Republican to take on a big corporation on a tax issue because they're not paying taxes at all or enough, their share, is a courageous thing for McCain to do, and he was a courageous guy generally. So I had a number of very good relationships with various Republicans that work with me on a permanent subcommittee and were with me when I was chair of the Armed Services Committee.
Those relationships, do you think that's what makes the Senate special?
It does. There's a lot of things which contribute to it. We're a smaller body. We get to know people a little bit better than with a much larger body like the House. It also is a special place because you have an opportunity, a guarantee in the Senate, unlike any other legislative body, probably in the world, including the House of Representatives, you're guaranteed an opportunity to offer amendments to legislation which is in front of you. And that opportunity means that everybody can offer a position that they take and have it debated and have it resolved. And that's a really extraordinary benefit of the United States Senate. It's why it should be the world's greatest deliberative body. It's fallen a lot short of that recently for a number of reasons. But that's why it has been called, and at times has been, a great deliberative body.
You were raised in Detroit, of course, the grandson of immigrants. And you say in the book that your family always talked politics at the dinner table, that lively discussion was just something your family did. You don't make any mention about how your mom felt about you and then eventually your brother Sandy ascending to these national offices. Do you think that that's something that she and perhaps your late father, like what they would have thought of that?
Well, my mother and dad were both deeply committed to public service. They were strong Democrats and believed in FDR. And My dad was very active in public life in a number of ways. My mother was she sort of accepted what came. She was more philosophical about life. She taught us about equality. She said, "You're no better than anybody else, but nobody else is better than you, and never forget it." She really, truly believed in that kind of decency towards people. But she also was philosophical about a number of other things. What came, you accept, is part of life. You accept setbacks as part of life. She was raised in a small town in Birmingham, Michigan. And my brother Sandy, our sister Hannah, who's now gone, but my brother and I were taught an awful lot by some loving parents about family and how important family is. And it's first and foremost in our lives. Now we got a nephew. I have a nephew, Andy Levin, who's in public life.
Right.
And he's carried on that tradition. But I also watch our kids. We have three daughters. We have six grandchildren. And I watch how our kids are so close to each other as they're now in their 50s. I see how their six children, two each, how close they are, loving cousins, keep in touch with each other, and how caring they are for their grandparents, how loving they are. So it's family is so important. And I grieve for anybody that has a broken family and where there's quarrels or dissent and divisiveness inside a family. It, you know, it hurts me, who's been the beneficiary of such a strong family, even to witness where that doesn't exist in other families. Oh, absolutely. It's the greatest place that I can imagine, other than a presidency, to be involved in public service, which is so, so important that people respect and understand and I think honor by the way in which they practice their public service and get engaged, looking for the good of the cause or the state or the district, and not after just always trying to do what's popular, which is a way of assuring one's own reelection. And that shouldn't be the mode of it. It shouldn't be doing the popular thing. It should be a willingness to, after thinking about it, listening to people, not being arrogant, doing what you think is best for your district, if you're elected official, or your state. There's a hundred different ways that people can serve their communities. And I think this country is so, the foundation in a way is helping each other, respecting each other, serving each other, sacrificing for each other, being part of a community. We talked about family before, which is number one in my book, but community is number two. Being part of a community that you are serving and helping, there's just so many ways of really being a public servant. And this country's been famous for that kind of commitment, and I hope always will be.
Senator Levin, thank you so much.
Good being with you, April.
That was Carl Levin from our conversation earlier this year during the release of his memoir, Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. Carl Levin died last night. He was 87 years old. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. We thank you so much for listening. Our staff is going to be taking a week, but we have some fabulous things lined up for you, including an hour-long examination of climate change in the Great Lakes. We know you'll like it. Have fun, be safe, and we'll be back with you in August. Bye-bye.